I'm Gail Hunt, and I'm excited to bring you Fun Time with Cliff Goodwin, a rock and talk series of Cliff's Tales from the Road, a behind-the-scenes look at his rock and roll adventures right here at WCUW. Dan and I sat down with Cliff Goodwin and got to hear his story from the start. So you're going to hear how the Beatles really changed music, how he still owes his grandmother some money, and never leave your axe in the car. So what got you started in music, Cliff?
Actually, it wasn't the Beatles. My aunt had an acoustic guitar that I didn't know existed until I happened to find it one day in a storage room where we lived on Institute Road at the time. And it was a Stella acoustic guitar, which became rather desirable again in that strange... That guitar always was kind of beckoning me, so to speak, you know? But of course, really, it was seeing the Beatles on and hearing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. And to some extent, the Beach Boys, although that was kind of elusive because we really didn't have a focus point with the Beach Boys, the early Beach Boy stuff. Surfing USA, Surfer Safari. Yeah.
So the focus point with the Beatles was the guitar?
No, a focus point was seeing them. I mean, I don't remember ever seeing the Beach Boys on TV. But in February of 64, I remember seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. And that...
So what was it like before the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, and what was it like after the Beatles on Ed Sullivan?
Well, before the Beatles, for me, musically, it was like a mirage. You could see where you thought you might be interested, because this, I'm 11 years old, right? So how much can you really, there's two things, really, girls and maybe girls. And then music was starting to creep in, but again, before the Beatles, this was after Elvis and before the bands which the Beatles spurned. So you're talking about a real fuzzy music scene, a lot of singles, you know, strange singles. Like I remember going downtown. My aunt worked in Denholm's, and Denholm's had a record department. And when I went to Catechism every Saturday morning, I was allowed to buy a record, you know, and back then, this was before the advent of LPs, you know, you could buy a single, you know, and I remember buying, innocuous singles. I remember one song, let me tell you about the birds and the bees and the flowers. I don't even remember who did that. You know, there was another tune called Don't Cross Over to My Side of the Street. You know, like I said, innocuous singles that didn't allow us to focus. But then when you saw the Beatles, all of a sudden it was like lifting your head out of a bucket of water. Mm. You know, oh, wow. Oh, really wow.
Now, in introducing the Beatles again, may I point out that they'll be on our show, as I told our audience, for the next two Sundays. Next Sunday from Deauville Hotel in the Miami Beach show, starring Hollywood's exciting Mitzi Gaynor. But ladies and gentlemen, once again,
she was just 17, you know what I mean, and the way she looked was way beyond compare. How could I dance with another? Oh, since I saw her standing there.
And again, we were aspiring to you could, back then, if you had three friends, all you needed to start a band was three people with a pulse. It didn't have to have anything to do with musical ability. It only had to do with who owned something that was in their cellar. You know, well, the kid that had a snare drum in his cellar from a marching band or whatever, he's the drummer.
Obviously.
You know, yeah. And then guitar players, as usual, even to this day, there's too many of us. You know, you can't...
Can't swing a cat without hitting one.
Well, yeah, you can't, exactly. Can't swing a guitar player without hitting a cat. And then I remember the keyboard player, our first keyboard player, he had an Emini air organ, which was horrible because it worked on air, you know? It was like this, someone will have to Google it but I remember we had a primitive microphone. You put the microphone up to the air organ, all you heard was air moving through the thing, you know? Was like trying to hear music through with a hairdryer. And then, of course, you know, the statistic which has been said many, many times, you know, let's assume the Beatles are on Ed Sullivan February 9th or 8th, 1964. Let's just say, for sake of argument, the 8th. On the 7th, there were 5,000 bands in America. On the 9th, there were 50,000.
Yeah.
It increased to an exponent. It wasn't just us in Worcester that saw this. The whole country said, oh, wow. But soon thereafter, there were bands that we as little urchins, 11-year-old, 12-year-old urchins, could actually go and see. And when you saw the band, a band, not the band, with, you know, Levon and other guys. When you saw a band of guys, and I remember seeing like the Mau Maus, a guy named Dave Webster, and Dickie Burke, I should know the other guy's names, but when you saw them, I remember they playing at Duffy Field, it was like, oh, wow, now I used to think I wanted to do this, now I know I can. Yeah. And then from there, it's all trial and error, isn't it?
You know? and I guess then my other question would be, like, what was your first electric guitar, or your first real axe, or...
My first real electric, well, I started taking lessons from Pete Clementi, mm-hmm. senior, not junior.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I took lessons for about 6 to 8 months and learned how to read music. Mm-hmm. But Pete wanted me to be a real guitarist, and I had no interest in that. I wanted to go, you know what I mean? So we kind of parted ways, although he gave me a great foundation. Loved him for that. But the first electric guitar I bought at Pete Clementi Music Studio, which was on Franklin Street,
nice.
76 Franklin Street, above a place called Circe's, next to the Capitol Theater, which turned out to be the Paris Cinema.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
To those of you who are a little bit younger, and it was a Howard guitar, absolute crap. I don't even know what, but it served the purpose of a beginner. You know, it's like asking a guy that eventually ran the marathon, you know, what was your first pair of sneakers? Well, it was probably a pair of, you know, Converse, you know, Chuck, whatever it is.
That's right.
That had nothing to do with being able to run 26 miles. If you tried to run 26 yeah. miles in a pair of those cheap plimsolls, that would be it for you, you know. So, yeah. But the first real guitar that I owned was a Kappa Continental,
ooh.
Which was, you know, very... very functional. I mean, you know, and right after that, I bought a 335 from Joe D'Angelo.
Wait.
As a matter of fact, I still got the receipt signed by Fred D'Angelo and my grandmother.
Oh my God.
Because my grandmother put up the money.
People, this is Worcester history.
Well, it is.
It is.
I found that receipt and I've got it. And it was like Cliff Goodwin, Victoria DeBrillo, who was my grandmother, and Fred D'Angelo, obviously their father. You know, Cliff Goodwin, out of his proceeds from his engagements, will reimburse his grandmother. You know, of course, that never happened. You know what I mean? But it was like, I think it was about $400. But it was a beautiful 335 from Joey. Joey's 335.
That's awesome.
Yeah. That eventually got stolen out in front of Emilio Studios on Newbury Street. You know, you want to talk about a hayseed, real, you know, corny Worcester guy. The guitar was in a hard shell case in the back seat of my car in front of Amedia Studios on Newbury Street in Boston. This is now the early 70s. And came out, and the car was intact. Guitar was gone. And this, I had never experienced crime living up, you know, being brought up in Worcester, you know.
Yeah,
I never experienced that type of crime, and I felt incredibly violated to the point where I was blown away, speechless. How could this happen? Mm. You know, but it did, and that guitar is gone. Yeah, way gone.
You're tuned to 91.3 on the FM dial, online at wcuw.org. I'm Gail Hunt, and this is The Drive, and this is a new series. We're calling it Rock and Talk. It's fun time with Cliff Goodwin, and we're just about to dive into his beginning bands. This is really interesting for all you rock history buffs. Here we go. Name of your bands? And
the first band was called The Exit Left, yeah. Again, we're at Forest Grove Junior High School, 7th, 8th graders. right? It was with a guy by the name of Danny Moriarty and Steve Lano, who is now a world-renowned, Stefan Lano is what he's called now. He's a world-renowned conductor of classical orchestras and operas. If you Google him, those of you at home, you'll be blown away. But he and a guy named Roger Brogy played drums. And, allegedly so. We had a singer. His name was Carl Mahoney. But the point I'm trying to make is all you had to say was you had a band. Yeah. And you had gigs. Now, we first started playing private parties because keep in mind this was a unique, special thing. You know, the older people would want a rock band at their party. It wasn't for kids. It was the older people. Yeah.
Right.
You know, that threw a party up, because they all lived up around Forest Street, Salisbury Street.
Older as in like 25, because you were still young.
What do
right?
I? Well, yeah, okay. Yeah, sure. Thanks, Gil. Yeah, right. Good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, young families who still wanted to be moving and shaking, you know, the Peppermint Twist. And so the people in that neighborhood, in that neck of Worcester, you know, had bread. They were obviously, that was a nice area. So we got some. You know, remember one time we played a block party on Rutland Terrace, which is right off of Salisbury Street. I guess one of the sponsors was Ralph Crowley Sr., who owned, you know, they owned Prowler and they also owned the Mountain.
Yeah.
And he was, and his wife, I don't remember her first name, but was so nice to us. Because keep in mind, we're the exit left sucked. I mean, our song list consisted of not songs we knew, but songs we wanted to play. So we didn't really have any songs other than a couple of real simple tunes like Gloria or Little Latin Loopy Lou or Louie Louie or whatever, you know, songs that were very elementary. But this lady, Mrs. Crowley, was so, so nice to us. And I remember one of the perks of that gig was Pola Orange Soda.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Still is.
You know what I mean? Yeah, still is. Because they lived, you know, up around there. But it was, you know, those were the memories. And of course, shortly thereafter, we're 12, 13 years old, we started playing frat parties for WPI.
Different scene?
All we knew was we were playing. The scene was, you know, drunken frat boys and Becker girls or whatever. I don't know. You know, we were tunnel vision. We were focused on our thing, you know, but we were the token. Isn't that cool? A band, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Of course, living in that neighborhood, we could literally walk to the gigs. You know, all the WPI fraternities were around Institute Road, Salisbury Street, you know, Boynton West, you know. So it was real easy to just walk to the gigs. I remember I found at one point a contract that I had made. It was not Exit Left. It was another band after that. I think it was called Appleton's Journal. But the bottom line was we got $66.
Nice.
And I'm looking at this contract, just cracking up, thinking that the negotiations were this. The social chairman of the fraternity, I think it was Theta Chi or something like that, or Lambda Chi from WPI, you know, he probably offered 60. And I said, no, we need 70. And we wound up at 66. Well, see, yeah, that's a whole... You know, the overview of that whole thing was, even at that young age, they looked at musicians. People still do look at musicians as nymphomaniac hookers. You know what I mean? They want to get paid, but they'll do it for free.
Yeah.
It's a shame. It really, really is.
Yeah.
And later on, many, many years later, when we started traveling to Europe on a regular basis, of course, with Joe Cocker, it became evident how artists, or even the regular guy, the baker, the butcher, the candlestick maker, had cachet, had street creds in Europe, where in this country they didn't. You know, the garbage man had street creds. He was an important part of the society in Europe. He did a really, really important, really important job. So he wasn't to be looked down upon. Well, in this country it was another story.
Yeah.
You know, so they still did look at musicians as, you know, well, you know, you guys are fine, right? You know, aren't you?
So in a lot of ways it sounds like you were in sort of the perfect place for a unique situation. I mean, you...
Totally, Dan. I remember, I every now and then I refer to that as being present at the crown of creation.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't mean to diminish the bands that you know, the Nirvanas and the grunge era and any other era. I'm not going to diminish that because that would be rude and discourteous. But we were present at the crown of creation, and you'd have to assume that the advent of the Beatles was the crown of creation, as far as that whole thing, that renaissance of major music.
Well, even George said, well, isn't everything after the Beatles still the Beatles?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was, well, back then, even right now, there's the Beatles and everybody else. You know, I'm sure Mick and Keith wouldn't agree with that, or, you know, the mega guys, but, you know, there's the Beatles, and then there's everybody else.
I'd like to thank Cliff Goodwin for this fun time episode. We look forward to hearing more next week. Tune in to The Drive at 5 and for our Rock and Talk series around 6 p.m.